VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English. On today's program, John Russell tells us about a surprising find among college-educated Americans. Dan Friedel presents this week's Health and Lifestyle Report. We close with the next episode of our American History series, The Making of a Nation. But first, it looks like the world's best male tennis player will be permitted to stay in Australia for now. Serbia's Novak Djokovic traveled to Melbourne last week to take part in the Australian Open. However, officials at the airport forced him to go to a hotel for travelers who have not been vaccinated against COVID-19. They also took away his visa. An Australian judge decided Monday that Djokovic would not have to return to Serbia. The judge said Djokovic should be permitted to leave the hotel immediately because he was not given enough time to speak with his lawyers. The judge also gave back Djokovic's visa. Djokovic had argued that he did not need a vaccine because he tested positive for COVID-19 in December. He arrived in Australia with an exemption from the vaccine requirement given to him by the organizers of the Australian Open. The competition starts January 17th. On Monday, Djokovic used Twitter to publish a picture of himself on a tennis court. A family member confirmed that Djokovic was training again. The story is not over, however. An Australian government lawyer said the immigration minister could still choose to cancel Djokovic's visa. If that happens, Djokovic could be sent back to Serbia and could be banned from entering Australia for 3 years. Government lawyers said an exemption should only be offered to visitors who recently recovered from a serious illness caused by COVID-19. The lawyers said there was no evidence that Djokovic was seriously ill in December. Alex Hawke is Australia's Minister for Immigration. A spokesperson said Hawke is currently considering the matter. Djokovic said on Twitter, "Despite all that has happened, I want to stay and try to compete." A win at the Australian Open would give Djokovic the record for total men's Grand Slam victories. A Grand Slam is one of the four major tennis tournaments worldwide. Djokovic currently has 20 Grand Slam titles.
A recent study found that Americans who completed college or university are more likely to have friends and are less lonely than those who only finished high school. The findings come at a time when many Americans question whether a college degree is worth its cost. Daniel Cox is director of the Survey Center on American Life and a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He said that, in general, Americans are experiencing a friend recession, meaning a decline in their number of friends. Cox noted that Americans have fewer close friends today than we did in the early 90s. But some groups were particularly affected in that they seem to have experienced a much more dramatic decline over that time period. He added, "And there are two groups that really stood out. The first is men, and the second one is people without a college degree." The Survey Center on American Life questioned 5,054 people this past summer. It found that Americans with a college degree feel more socially connected and are more active in their communities than people who did not go to college. As a result, those who completed college report feeling less lonely. Cox believes that the issue is a result of the decline in traditional institutions, meaning religion, marriage, and unions. Unions were primarily financial, but they also offered a lot of social support and social connection and feelings of belonging as well. The decline of unions, the decline of marriage, and the decline of religion have all disproportionately affected the non-college group. Disproportionately, in this case, means too large in relation to something. Previous research shows that Americans who did not go to college are less likely to marry. A 2013 study of people born between 1957 and 1964 found that both men and women who did not finish high school were less likely to marry than those with more education. A 2012 study found that college-educated women were much more likely to get married than women who dropped out of high school. Cox points to research that shows that people who are married are more likely to have larger social groups and more close friends and report feeling lonely less often. Today, 65% of college-educated Americans over age 25 are married, but 50% of people with a high school diploma or who dropped out of high school are married. Those numbers were different in 1990, when marriage rates among the college-educated were at 69%, compared with 63% for those who did not go to college, says a Pew Research report. Pew also finds that Americans are less religious overall. The percentage of Americans who say they're religiously unaffiliated rose from 17% in 2009 to 26% in 2018 and 2019. When it comes to unions, the percentage of workers who belong to a union has declined by almost half since 1983, when 20% of U.S. workers were union members. Union membership had dropped to 10.8% by 2020. The American Community Life Survey found that around 1 in 10 college graduates say they have no close social connections. That number rises among Americans without a degree, where almost 1 in 4 say they have no close friends. I'm John Russell.
Gardening expert Lee Reich wrote about planting flowers, vegetables, and more on his land for 30 years. In his final story, he wanted to leave his readers with some advice. Over the years, he wrote about tomatoes, how to cut flowers, and the worries about household pets eating indoor plants. He said he was happy to write about working in the garden for gardeners of all levels. He decided to offer 8 pieces of information to help people who grow plants at home, whether they do it on a large piece of land or just two or three containers inside. Reich said items that were once alive are good to mix into the soil you use to grow plants. This includes leftover foods, green clippings, and leaves that fall from trees. They help keep water in the soil and feed microorganisms that help plants. Yes, Reich said, some insects can hurt plants. But it is normal for insects and fungi and other organisms to hurt your garden. He said, people who work with plants need to learn how to accept a little damage. When plants get hurt, he said, they come back in other ways, like growing stronger where they are not injured. He said, it is a good idea to be thoughtful and find a natural way to fight insects before using a chemical treatment. Reich said Mother Nature has been helping the Earth develop food and plants for a long time. Gardeners, he said, should not be too worried about ground cover that grows naturally. Some people call these weeds. Reich also noted that it is important to think carefully about the soil you plant in. Do not put plants that are best in dry parts of the world where it is very wet. Do not put plants that do best in wet conditions where it is very dry. Each year, he said, it is a good idea to take photos of your garden and write down what you planted and when you did the work. That way, you can learn from what worked well and what did not. The next year, you can decide what to plant based on your past experience. Former U.S. President Thomas Jefferson once wrote, "Though an old man, I am a young gardener." His archives show good notes about his gardens. Example 1. Some people think pulling weeds from the garden is not fun, but Reich says that is not the right way to think of the job. A good idea is to look at your garden and take the weeds out every 3 or 4 days. That way, the work never takes too long. When you change the way you think, he said, a job once seen as difficult can become enjoyable. One other warning, do not turn over the soil too much. That work often turns over weed seeds that would not grow otherwise. Example 2, Reich said you should mix and match plants and flowers. There's no reason you cannot plant eggplant, peppers, and other vegetables with your flowers. Those plants look nice, and the flowers will bring helpful insects like bees to the garden. Example 3. You can plant fruit trees wherever you want. You do not need an orchard. Many fruit trees look nice by themselves, along with producing food that tastes good. Reich wrote about plants for 30 years, but sometimes he has questions. In those cases, he searches on the internet, but he centers his searches on information from educational institutions and government agencies. Even if the sources are not right 100% of the time, most of the time, they have good information. It is hard to see the difference sometimes between good information and bad when it comes from sources you do not know well. Sometimes bad weather can hurt plants. Other times, disease can hurt them. If you plant vegetables that are ready to eat at different times of the year, you can make sure that even if there is a problem in August or September, you picked something good to eat earlier in the year. In Reich's experience, one year in the northeastern United States, a sickness late in the summer hurt many tomato plants, but that year he already picked peppers, corn, kale, and other vegetables. You may get advertisements. You may go past a plant store that looks good. Even warm weather early in the year might make you excited to start planting. But Reich says it is better to have a small garden than a large one. When he has friends come over, they admire all his fruits and vegetables. However, he warns, don't do this at home. In the end, Reich said he may not be writing as much. However, he will never stop working in his garden. He will plant some new items and remove old ones in the next year. For example, he wants to plant rhododendrons and winterberry. He will build another stone wall he can use to support lingonberry and dwarf sweetbox. The work never ends. Even if he is not writing as often, Reich plans to keep writing on his own website, leereich.com. You can visit him there if you want to keep up with his work and perhaps see photos of his new projects. He will be working hard, even on the cold days of winter. I'm Dan Friedel.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Theodore Roosevelt became President of the United States at the beginning of the 20th century. It was a time of great technological progress in the United States. Yet many people felt that there was too little social progress. They demanded reforms in politics, industry, and the use of natural resources. Theodore Roosevelt supported this call for reforms. His first target was big business. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe continue the story of the presidency of Teddy Roosevelt.
In the early 1900s, a group of wealthy American businessmen agreed to join their railroads. They formed a company or trust to control the joint railroad. The new company would have complete control of rail transportation in the American West. There would be no competition. President Roosevelt believed the new company violated the Sherman antitrust law. The law said it was illegal for businesses to interfere with trade among the states. Roosevelt said he would make no compromises in enforcing the law. He asked the Supreme Court to break up the railroad trust. "We are not," Roosevelt said, "attacking these big companies. We are only trying to do away with any evil in them. We are not hostile to them, but we believe they must be controlled to serve the public good."
The Supreme Court ruled against the railroad trust. In the next few years, other trusts would be broken up in the same way. The American people called this trust busting, and they called Theodore Roosevelt the trust buster. Roosevelt made several speeches explaining his position on big business. Everywhere he went, he found wide public support. Later, he told a friend why people liked him so well. He said, "I put into words what is in their hearts and minds, but not in their mouths."
President Roosevelt won even more public support for his actions during a labor crisis in the coal industry. The incident was one of many in American history in which a president had to decide if he should interfere in private industry. Coal miners went on strike in the spring of 1902. They demanded more pay and safer working conditions. Mine owners refused to negotiate. One even insulted the miners. He said, "The rights and interests of the laboring man will be protected and cared for. It will not be the labor activists who take care of him. It will be the Christian men to whom God, in his great wisdom, has given the control of the property interests of this country." This self-serving use of religion made many Americans support the striking workers.
After several months, President Roosevelt invited coal mine owners and union leaders to a meeting in Washington. He asked them to keep in mind that a third group was involved in their dispute, the public. He warned that the nation faced the possibility of a winter without heating fuel. Roosevelt said, "I did not call this meeting to discuss your claims and positions. I called it to appeal to your love of country." The union leaders said they were willing to have the president appoint an independent committee to settle the strike. They said they would accept the committee's decision as final. The mine owners rejected the idea. One warned the president not even to talk about it. Such talk, he said, was illegal interference in private industry.
That made Theodore Roosevelt angry. Later, he said, "If it were not for the high office I held, I would have taken him by the seat of the pants and the nape of the neck and thrown him out the window." Finally, Roosevelt got both sides to agree to a compromise. Mine owners agreed to have an independent committee study the miners' demands, and the miners agreed to return to work until the study was completed. Several months later, the report was ready. The committee proposed that miners accept a smaller pay increase in exchange for improved working conditions. Both sides accepted the proposal. The coal strike ended.
Not everyone was happy. Many people still felt Roosevelt had no right to interfere. Roosevelt disagreed. "My business," he said, "is to see fair play among all men, capitalists or wage workers. All I want to do is see that every man has a fair deal, no more, no less." Roosevelt believed the United States needed a strong leader. He planned to strengthen the presidency whenever he could. Roosevelt was an active, noisy man. As one writer described him, "Theodore is always the center of action. When he goes to a wedding, he wants to be the bride. When he goes to a funeral, he wants to be the dead man." Many of Roosevelt's friends thought he was an overgrown boy. "You must always remember," one said, "that the president is about 6 years old." Another friend sent this message to Roosevelt on his 46th birthday. You have made a very good start in life. We have great hopes for you when you grow up.
Theodore Roosevelt loved outdoor activities. He especially loved the natural beauty of the land. He worried about its future. Roosevelt wrote, "I recognize the right and duty of this generation to develop and use the natural riches of our land, but I do not recognize the right to waste them, nor to rob, by wasteful use, the generations that come after us." Roosevelt set aside large areas of forest land for national use. He created 50 special areas to protect wildlife, and he established a number of national parks.
Theodore Roosevelt faced the responsibilities of foreign policy with the same strength he used in facing national problems. He firmly believed in expanding American power in the world. "We have no choice," he said, "as to whether or not we will play a great part in the world. All that we can decide is whether we will play our part well or poorly." To play well, Roosevelt said, the United States needed a strong navy. It also needed a canal across Central America so the navy could sail quickly between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans.
For many years, people had dreamed of such a waterway. With a canal across Central America, ships could sail directly from ocean to ocean. They would not have to make the long, costly voyage around the southern end of South America. The most likely place to build such a canal was at the thinnest point of land, Panama. Another possible place was just to the north, Nicaragua. Over the years, several attempts were made to build the canal.
In the 1880s, Ferdinand de Lesseps, builder of the Suez Canal, formed a French company to build a waterway across Panama. De Lesseps spent $300 million to build just one-third of the canal. He could get no more money. His company failed. In the 1890s, an American company tried to build a canal across Nicaragua. It made little progress. After 3 years, it gave up the attempt. When Theodore Roosevelt became president in the early 1900s, he was ready to try again.
A study was made to decide which would be a better place for the canal, Panama or Nicaragua. Engineers said it would cost less to complete the canal de Lesseps had started 20 years earlier in Panama. But de Lesseps' company still owned the land on which the canal would be built. The United States would have to buy the land as well as the rights to build the waterway. The study decided it would be less costly overall to build the canal in Nicaragua. The proposal went to the United States Congress for approval.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.